You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Rick Wayman of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation about the David versus Goliath story of how the tiny Marshall Islands have filed lawsuits against the 9 nuclear-armed nations to force them to start negotiations for the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons.
The Marshall Islands was used by the U.S. as a nuclear test site for about 12 years. During that time, the U.S. conducted 67 nuclear tests in the Marshall Islands, mostly above-ground atmospheric tests that were hugely damaging to the environment and especially to the people.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio, Aguano, Wolozikawoba. Welcome and greetings to you in my native language. I'm coming to you from a very gray and cloudy state of Maine, in and along the banks of the beautiful Bunawapskek River here in the Dawnland Wabanaki Territory in central Maine. And as ever, I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Hi, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. Pertinent to today's conversation, I'm sitting in Taos, New Mexico, under the shadow of Los Alamos, as we like to say. Since we're going to be talking about nuclear weapons and the very long global shadow that we all live under, in terms of the work that needs to be done for disarmament, it's a bit of a sobering reminder to understand how close these really, truly, weapons of mass destruction are to the places that we live, work, and breathe. And we're going to talk about a set of lawsuits today that brings it even closer to home with some stories about some people who have been severely impacted by the very, very brutal reality of nuclear weapons. To have this conversation, we're going to talk with Rick Wayman of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. He is the director of programs there. He is working closely with the international legal team and representatives from the Marshall Islands, coordinating a collaborative effort of over 100 NGOs in support of the Marshall Islands lawsuit, which we're going to talk about. Tiny little Marshall Islands hauled off and sued the 9 nuclear weapon nations in the world. So it's very, very intriguing. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Thanks so much, Rivera and Sherry. I appreciate you having me.
Rick, this is going to be a really interesting program, and we're really excited to have you with us today to talk about this. This is really a David and Goliath kind of story, where you have the Marshall Islands taking on these giants who have failed to uphold their responsibilities in the Non-Proliferation Agreement and other agreements that have unfolded to breach some type of peace. And I'd like to begin by having you just give us an overview. How did this case come to be? What were the precipitating circumstances? And where is it now?
The majority of the cases are based primarily on Article 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That treaty came into effect in 1970, so over 46 years ago. And Article 6 calls for good faith negotiations, for an end to the nuclear arms race at an early date, and nuclear disarmament. So there are a number of things in that article that are interesting and that are really clearly being breached. First, the phrase at an early date. Like I said, this treaty's been in effect for 46 years. So the early date part hasn't happened as yet. As for negotiating an end to the nuclear arms race, also, unfortunately, has not been happening. What we are seeing just in really coming to light in the past couple months, but something that's been going on for a number of years now, can really be considered a new nuclear arms race, or the second major nuclear arms race. And that's because all of the nuclear armed countries, all nine of them, are in some way, shape, or form modernizing their nuclear arsenals, creating more precise weapons, weapons with varying yields. In the case of the U.S., even building total new production facilities. So things are happening worldwide, and the Marshall Islands wants to put a stop to it. You mentioned the Marshall Islands is a very small country. And one thing that I have found very inspiring in the position that the Marshall Islands has taken in these cases is that they may be small. You know, the Marshall Islands may have a population of 70,000, while China, for example, has a population of over 1 billion. But in the eyes of the court, they're equals. You know, under UN rules, they're equal. So that's really inspiring to me that a small country with very limited economy and very little capacity for a diplomatic presence around the world has been willing to step up like this. A little bit of history for your listeners who might not know, the Marshall Islands was used by the U.S. as a nuclear test site for about 12 years, from 1946 to 1958. During that time, the U.S. conducted 67 nuclear tests in the Marshall Islands, mostly above-ground atmospheric tests that were hugely damaging to the environment and especially to the people in the area. There are many places within the Marshall Islands that remain uninhabitable. There are radiation effects that are continuing to crop up, both in people who were alive during the testing, as well as new generations that are being born. So these are long-term problems that have been created by the U.S. in a very small nation that has really totally reshaped the face of what life looks like to a traditional people.
I think that's a really part of this David and Goliath story, and what's so important about people understanding the history of the Marshall Islands and how courageous they are being after witnessing firsthand the long-lasting effects of being exposed to the radiation of nuclear weapons. I find it really personally inspiring as well, because here in New Mexico, the Los Alamos National Laboratory is trying to become the nation's, I guess it's not their first ever in the history of nuclear weapons, but the first for the modernization program, plutonium pit production facility. Right now, this essential production unit is not available in the U.S. We just don't do it anymore. We stopped it years ago. And so Los Alamos wants to become the facility that makes plutonium pits. It's a critical juncture for citizens to be aware of nuclear weapons and aware of what we can do to stop the proliferation of them. And as you said, this modernization is really a new proliferation wave. I was wondering if you would speak a little bit about the variable ton factor that you were speaking about. You know, most people know that over the years we've actually increased the size and scale and scope of the nuclear weapons so that they're much bigger than what was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But the modernization program is talking about these dial-a-ton bombs where you can just hone one down to just take out one little village somewhere. Could you please debunk that for our listeners and talk about why this is such a concerning factor of modernization?
Sure. Well, it's really very much like you said it. During the Cold War, the U.S. and Soviet Union were racing to see who could build the biggest, most powerful bomb. The U.S. Exploded one in the Marshall Islands in 1954 that was 15 megatons. That's 15 million tons of TNT. That's over 1,000 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. The Soviets, their largest bomb was 50 megatons. So things were getting completely out of control. I mean, that is just totally beyond what really any of us can comprehend, the magnitude of these. So what they're doing now is they're scaling that back, and they're some of the modernized bombs that are being created. The B-61-12 is a gravity bomb that is, among other things, deployed in five countries in Europe right now. So so the program that is modernizing those bombs is planning to have what they call dial-a-yield. So it, depending on the target that is selected, they could choose a very low yield, much less than what was dropped on Hiroshima, or a medium yield or a high yield. And it all depends on what sort of target they're going after. If they're going under some sort of heavily fortified underground bunker or something on the surface, et cetera. And the biggest danger here is that with particularly with the small yields, some military commanders and national leaders could see nuclear weapons as being more usable. So the threshold that you have to cross into the use of nuclear weapons could be much less. And we've heard that from military experts, former generals, people who in their military careers had significant decision-making powers over nuclear weapons and the strategy. So it's very disturbing and not something at all that any of us want to go down. Some might say, oh, we're just going to use one little nuclear weapon to take out a target. But first of all, that's breaking a 71-year taboo on the use of nuclear weapons, which in and of itself is a huge deal. But it also, it's hard to imagine escalation not taking place. So if the U.S. uses a nuclear weapon against one of its enemies, you might call them, it's hard to imagine either that enemy itself or one of its nuclear armed allies not responding in kind, leading to inevitable escalation. And with over 15,000 nuclear weapons in the world, that's something that can never happen if we want to survive as a civilization.
Well, Rick, there's a lot of things that people don't necessarily understand about the law. One of those things is the hierarchy of the laws, how the hierarchy plays out in the determination of which laws are in effect at a given time. And one of the things that I think is really important about this case is that treaty law under constitutional law is the second highest law in the land, and that it rules over all statutory law and case law. And the fact that these nation states are violating this treaty is nothing to be looked at lightly. This is a purposeful violation of the law, both domestic and international, for all of these nations that are involved in these lawsuits. And I would like to get into that a little bit, because Article 6, which is what we're talking about here, is not conditioned on the discretion or any type of value determination of the leaders of these nation states, including the U.S. And so when we start looking at the violation of this treaty and the lack of execution of the terms of this treaty, which was ratified by the U.S. Congress, we're talking about a nation state here in the U.S., along with others, that is clearly and purposefully not following the laws that they set forth. And so when we're being ruled by those who have no respect for the law, and yet they expect others to operate within the confines of the law, it creates a real imbalance within the society, not just here in this country, but on a global scale. So can we talk about the actual obligations under the treaty, and what is it that these, specifically, what is it that they're doing that, or they're required to be doing that they're not doing under the treaty?
Sherry, before I do that, let me just back up for a second. What I didn't explain at the beginning is that there are two venues where these lawsuits are being heard. One
right.
is at the International Court of Justice, and the Marshall Islands in 2014 filed nine separate lawsuits, again, one for each of the nine nuclear-armed nations. So that's at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. And then simultaneously, the Marshall Islands filed another lawsuit only against the U.S., in U.S. federal district court. And that one, that domestic U.S. case, is where they're really bringing U.S. constitutional law into play. There's different there's different types of law and different types of arguments that are made at the International Court of Justice. But it does all revolve around these existing international legal obligations to negotiate for disarmament. So what are the obligations under the treaty? And I should add, it's not only under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. A number of the nuclear armed countries are not part of that treaty, and they have been sued in the International Court of Justice under what's called customary international law. So another big part of the argument for why nuclear disarmament is part of customary international law is that 20 years ago, in 1996, the International Court of Justice gave an advisory opinion on nuclear weapons, and they concluded unanimously that there exists an obligation to negotiate in good faith and bring to a conclusion negotiations for nuclear disarmament in all of its aspects. The exact wording is not quite that, but that's the idea. So the International Court, in that opinion, didn't restrict the obligation to the countries that have signed the Nonproliferation Treaty or the countries that feel like doing it. They said that there exists an obligation, period. It applies across the board. So under that interpretation of international law, coming from the World Court, that would mean that all of the nine nuclear armed countries are in breach of their obligations. So what is happening and what's not happening right now? I mean, what's not happening is negotiations. The nuclear armed countries are very capable of working together. They show that. Take, for example, the negotiations a year plus ago around Iran and its nuclear program. The P5 showed that they were quite capable of having a common objective and working to achieve it, making some concessions, you know, negotiating. That's how negotiations work. And there came a result of that, and things are looking pretty good, you know, depending on your perspective. But the fact is, they sat down, they negotiated, they came up with a result. So they proved that it can be done. What's lacking among the nuclear armed countries is the political will and the courage to make it happen. So they right now are not negotiating an end to the nuclear arms race. They're not negotiating nuclear disarmament. When they do get together and talk at something like a nonproliferation treaty review conference, they're talking about very small steps. They're talking about very limited things. They like to talk about a step-by-step process that ensures global security for all parties. But these are all ways to delay and to maintain the status quo. So I think really the clearest indication of where the nuclear armed states stand right now is something that actually happened just 3 days ago. At the UN in Geneva, the open-ended working group came to a conclusion. That was a UN-mandated conference that met in February, May, and August of this year, and it was open to all countries, and it was also open to the participation of NGOs. And the intention of the conference was to come up with plans to take forward multilateral nuclear disarmament negotiations. I mean, that to me, that's something that everyone should be behind. That's something that all of these countries, when they signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, that's what that treaty is meant to do, was result in nuclear disarmament negotiations. So all nine nuclear armed countries boycotted the open-ended working group. They didn't show up. In some cases, they just talked down about it. In other cases, they actively tried to prevent it from ever happening. In the case of the U.S., they had some allied countries, most notably Australia, acting as a surrogate at the open-ended working group, trying to spoil the event, trying to prevent a positive outcome from occurring. But in a very exciting development, what did come of it was a recommendation from the open-ended working group for negotiations to take place next year in 2017 for a treaty banning nuclear weapons. So this is something that will likely take place at the beginning. It will be negotiated without the participation of the nuclear-armed states and maybe some of their allies, some of the allies in NATO and others that are under the direct influence of U.S. nuclear weapons. But it's something that is nonetheless happening. So there are a number of countries that have stood up. They've had enough, and they're actually moving this forward. So they are fulfilling their part of the international bargain. They are creating the conditions to negotiate for nuclear disarmament. And then the countries with nuclear weapons are resisting, they're boycotting, and they're actively trying to undermine the effort. So there are a number of countries out there, not just the Marshall Islands, that are really stepping up and taking a lead on this. And it's a really positive development and something that I'm very happy to see.
So let me be just a little bit of the cynical person on the line here. I'm curious, and let's say the Marshall Islands wins their David and Goliath case against the 9 nuclear weapons holding countries, and let's say this treaty banning nuclear weapons happens. What happens if, you know, the U.S. just continues to belligerently and arrogantly just ignore all sorts of international laws like it's been doing for decades now? What then happens? I mean, if they lose the case against the Marshall Islands, what are the sanctions placed on the U.S.? If they're in violation of the theoretical treaty banning nuclear weapons, I presume another kind of lawsuit happens showing them to be in violation of it. And then what happens? How do the various international ruling bodies plan to hold the U.S. accountable to the laws that are in effect or that we may even ignore at some point?
Well, the big problem, well, I don't know that it's a problem, but something that is presenting a block here is that there's no international police force. There is no actual enforcement mechanism. It's more of a stigma. It's more of a kind of a moral pressure, because ultimately what prevents a rogue state from being rogue, you know, there's nothing short of military force, which is not at all what anyone is advocating here. So it's something that we just have to create enough pressure in society, create enough of a stigma against nuclear weapons, make those that are clinging to them be more and more outcast, and convince them that the only way to go is to get rid of them. So having a favorable judgment in these lawsuits is not going to be the end point, but it's going to be another feather in the cap for nuclear disarmament and for the global effort. And, you know, it will hopefully give cover to some of the leaders of at least certain nuclear-armed nations that might otherwise resist, if they can have this judgment to point to say, look, you know, this is what the law says we have to do, so we're going to do it, and we're going to sit down at the table, we're going to convene negotiations and see what happens. And ultimately, that's all that the Marshall Islands is asking for in these lawsuits. They're not trying to define a certain outcome from the negotiations. They just want negotiations to take place, and they'll end up how they end up. But the Marshall Islands' point here is negotiations are required, and negotiations are not happening. So that's step one. We'll see where that goes and take it from there. So like you said, maybe there will be more lawsuits in the future. Who knows what will happen, but there are plenty of people around the world that are paying attention and that are ready to act and do whatever we have to do to make this happen.
Rick, I get so frustrated by some of these things, because we know that there is an immoral nature to this ongoing war for profit mechanism that we're all operating under, that's being conducted in our names across the world, and that moral pressure to that structure doesn't seem to have any effect. The way that the war machine has conducted itself in recent history is abominable. I mean, it's just horrific, the destruction that it has wrought around the world. And so, you know, I kind of am thinking along the same lines as Rivera here. You have these countries coming together to stop others. You said they've proven that they can come together and to work toward a common goal. Well, that common goal was to stop others from having the same type of destructive capacity that they have, which means that they were coming together for a specific purpose to prevent anyone else from being able to take the power position that they've been holding for so long, which is certainly not an ethical or moral stance for them to take. And, you know, wondering what kind of impact a ban will have if they've demonstrated that they're already willing to fail to uphold their obligations to date under both domestic and international law. You mentioned that there's no international police force, and that's concerning on many levels, because what does that mean? There are definitely reasons for there to be some type of international police force, but there's also great concern with what that police force will then have the capacity to do in regard to the rise in this militarized state of police action that we've been seeing across the world. And it's important to note that the U.S. has never signed onto any agreement, really, that contains any type of enforcement mechanism. There are no teeth in a lot of these international mechanisms. They have no enforcement capacity because, like you said, there's no body to enforce them. But also, when we look at the U.S. and think about the things that have happened here, where the banks that were too big to fail were bailed out, in a lot of ways, the U.S. is too big to sanction in any meaningful way because of its contributions to the international markets. And so do you think that there is anything realistically that can come of this that will actually impact the way that these big, powerful, militarized nation states conduct business?
Well, you know, I think right now, It is revolving around money, unbelievable amounts of money. The U.S. right now is at the beginning of a $1 trillion 30-year nuclear modernization program. Other countries are spending less than that, but still very significant amounts. So while that profit motive is in place, it is going to be very difficult to get them to do anything about it. But this is something that I've learned over the years from my colleague, Paul Chappelle, who, Sherry, I know you know very well. There are things that happen in the world that we can't really predict or really envision at a certain point in history. And then something happens, something changes, and then it suddenly seems like, of course, that was always going to happen. So, you know, I think that right now we can't necessarily envision this crazy cycle of greed and destruction from ever breaking. But I believe that if we keep trying, we're going to get onto something that is going to break it. I don't know what that something is. Maybe these lawsuits are going to chip away at it. Maybe these lawsuits are going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. I don't know, but I strongly believe that we have to keep trying. We have to keep being creative, and we can't give up. If we give up, then there's no way that positive change is going to happen. So, yeah, I don't have a specific answer or even a specific vision of what it would look like, but I do believe that it can and will happen with enough creative and sustained effort from people like all of us.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and a special side note from Sherry Mitchell on the historical and legal meanings of negotiating in good faith.
When we talk about honoring our agreements, what we are really talking about is upholding our social contracts, such as adherence to the established law. This requires us to act in good faith. The term good faith is derived from the Latin phrase bona fide, or what is commonly referred to in English as bona fide. It involves fair and open dealing in human interactions, and on a larger scale, fair and humane dealings with the rest of creation. Good faith is often thought to require sincere, honest intentions or belief, regardless of the outcome of an action. While some Latin phrases lose their literal meaning over centuries, this is not the case with bona fide. It is still widely used and interchangeable with its generally accepted modern-day translation of good faith. It is an important concept within law, philosophy, and business. It has become synonymous with credentials and integrity. In regard to the law, the U.S. has a legally binding obligation under Article 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty to pursue its negotiations in good faith. Good faith is not some qualitatively subjective standard. It has real meaning. In the context of Article 6 of the treaty, good faith imposes a standard of objective reasonableness. Moreover, a significant practical consequence of the good faith principle is that a party which committed itself in good faith to a course of conduct would be prohibited from acting inconsistently with its commitment. As set forth in the Restatement of the Law of Contracts, promulgated by the American Law Institute, good faith performance or enforcement of an agreement emphasizes faithfulness to an agreed common purpose and consistency with the justified expectations of the other parties. It excludes a variety of types of conduct characterized as involving bad faith because they violate community standards of decency, fairness, or reasonableness. In other words, they violate the social contract. A complete catalog of types of bad faith is impossible, but the following types are among those which have been recognized in judicial decisions: evasion of the spirit of the bargain, lack of diligence, and slacking off, willful rendering of imperfect performance, abuse of a power to specify terms, and interference with or failure to cooperate in the other party's performance. And significantly, evasions violate the obligation of good faith in performance, even though the actor believes his conduct to be justified. Thus, the U.S. may be found to be in violation of the treaty, even if the executive believes that such violation is justified. In violating the treaty, the U.S. is violating its social contract not only with its citizens, but with the rest of the world. Good faith requires refraining from actions undermining the achievement of the disarmament objective, such as modernization of nuclear forces and infrastructure to last for the foreseeable future. Courts routinely apply the good faith standard and judge the good faith of parties, and the standard of good faith is a judicially manageable standard. However, it is also a moral and social standard that we as citizens of this nation and of the world have a duty to uphold. We have a responsibility to frame our social contracts, which are the parameters under which we wish to live, in such a way as to hold life as the highest valuation factor. As you're listening this week, we encourage you to consider the social contracts that you live under and to determine what the value structure is that supports those contracts. If life is not the highest value, then we encourage you to think of ways to elevate the value of life to the highest place within those systems, and to then begin working to make those new systems into a viable social contract for your communities well into the future.
This week's featured music is Moody's Blues by SFT. You can find this and other tracks on Jamendo.com. And now, let's return to our program with Rick Wayman. One of the things that I've always wondered what might transpire is if we saw the people who work in international law, international treaties, international diplomacy, large-scale issues like nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament, sat down with people who are on-the-ground grassroots organizers who have experienced firsthand the betrayal of the justice systems of various levels, the betrayal of police, the betrayal of politicians, the betrayal of economic systems, and have found that the way that they can move forward is through grasping real tools of civil resistance, nonviolent action, and non-cooperation. And what might unfold in terms of our understanding of strategy on how to approach these issues? Because the people who I'm thinking about have very little faith that a law will help them or a court will help them. What they understand is that at the end of the day, the things, the materials, the resources, the people, the humans, the skills and knowledge that the problem or the oppressor or the tyrant needs, at the end of the day, those things cannot be allowed to reach that person. And they must be put back into the position of a little person in a room just having a tantrum, wanting orders to be obeyed and nothing happening. And these are the kinds of things that people who don't have a lot of access to traditional halls of power, let's say, have had to learn about. So I've always been curious how that conversation might unfold around an issue like this. It certainly has a lot of room for thought exploration. We have seen large nation states applying certain levels of this, such as sanctions and economic boycotts. And those sorts of things that Sherry said with the U.S. are challenging because of the scope of the U.S.'s domination. Sherry said contributions, but I think domination is probably the more accurate word about how we relate to the international economic arena. My question for you, Rick, is on the website having to do with these lawsuits that the Marshall Islands have initiated to get negotiations happening. There are 5 million people who have signed on in support of these lawsuits. And my question for you is, where do you place global awareness and resistance to nuclear weapons at now compared to, say, the 1980s and compared to, say, the 1950s?
You know, that's a great question. And I would say, in general, there's less awareness right now of the threats, the existence, and really the scale of the threat that is hanging over us every day. It's discouraging to see some of the polls and some of these interviews online that are played as being comical, where they ask someone what should be a simple question and they have no idea what the answer is. You know, that's very much the case with nuclear weapons. If you were to ask the average person here in the U.S. how many countries have nuclear weapons, I don't think they would know the answer. If you were to ask them how many nuclear weapons does the U.S. have, I think that the answers would be across the board, but wildly inaccurate. And really, I think where the real lack of knowledge is hurting is that I don't think people realize or maybe they don't want to think about the actual effects that these weapons can have. They don't want to believe that they can be used. They don't want to believe that they could wipe out everything that we know and love within seconds. And I think that we've got to come to grips with that, both as individuals and as a global community, if we're going to outlaw these and get rid of them and live without them. We simply can't go on like this, assuming that the idea of nuclear deterrence is going to hold up, that this kind of imagined threat of mutually assured destruction is going to prevent them from ever being used. I just don't think that's true. And so there's a lot of complacency out there right now, and it's very difficult to break out of that. One of the biggest ways that a lot of people nowadays share information is through social media like Facebook, and it's a lot easier to share a picture of your cute daughter or a cat than it is information about nuclear weapons and what they're capable of. You know, that's just, I think, the way that people want to interact with the world is not to think about actual existential threats. So I don't know what the answer is to breaking that, but it has to be done. We have to recognize, all of us, that this is not okay. And if we want future generations to survive and thrive, getting rid of nuclear weapons has got to be, if not at the very top of the list, one of the top couple things that we all need to work on and dedicate ourselves to.
This is absolutely right. And we have so many other issues that people are working on that they're focused on. And we know that you can't work on every single issue. Otherwise, your energy and your light becomes too diffused to make any type of impact. We need people with laser focus on specific issues in order for them to be able to move those issues along. However, we're not going to have the time to be able to sort out the rest of our problems if we're all dead from a nuclear holocaust. And I think that this is probably, like you said, at the top of the list of the things that we need to work on, that the contamination and destruction of our waterways is right there with that, I think, because we can't survive on this planet without water, and we have a finite amount of water. When I think about these issues as an attorney, I'm painfully aware that the law is a fiction, that its enforceability lies in its value, or, you know, its valuation within the society. It's part of our social contract. And so when you have these large nation states that are willing to breach its treaty obligations and to breach the supreme laws of their own lands, like the United States breaching the supreme law of the land, which is the Constitution, we need to start looking at our value structure and begin to renegotiate our social contracts. I think that changing our value structures and shifting them away from profit, because mostly what we're talking about here is a value structure that holds profit higher than human life. We have to change that value structure within our society and redevelop our social contracts based on that shift. And so a lot of the work that we're doing here on the radio show, the work that Rivera and I do out in the world, is about having those discussions with people. How do we change our value structure away from this profit-driven model that has been embedded into our psyche as the way that it is, to a value system that places life, human life, the life of the planet, the life of all other living beings at the top? And I'm interested to hear, I know that you all do a lot of really good work at the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, including my friend Paul, who you mentioned earlier, does incredible work in helping people to have those conversations and to start thinking about that. So do you have any ideas that you could share with our listeners about how do we begin the process in our local areas of shifting and facilitating discussions about shifting our value structure away from profit and moving it closer to a value structure that holds at the highest point life?
Well, there's a very specific example of something that's happening right now that I think is really doing both of those things. And it centers around a report titled Don't Bank on the Bomb. This report is free to check out and peruse at don'tbankonthebomb.com. Some of our colleagues from around the world, mostly at a group called PAX in the Netherlands, has authored this report each year for the past couple years. And they go into great detail about the companies that are profiting from nuclear weapons. And so not just your usual suspects like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, which we all know are reaping billions and billions of dollars each year from not only nuclear weapons, but many other types of weapons as well. But they also go into what are the companies that are financing the production of nuclear weapons. And that is really where, to me, it gets shocking. If you check out this report, I think odds are you'll see your bank that you use, you know, Bank of America, for example, Wells Fargo. You'll see your bank. The report will detail how many dollars they're financing, how many nuclear weapon producing companies they're financing. And so you have a little bit of leverage right there to personally extricate yourself from that part of the nuclear weapons system. I went through that process myself about a year and a half ago. I found out that the parent company of my bank was on this list of financial institutions that's funding nuclear weapon producers. And it was a bit of an arduous process, but I got out of it, and I can now talk to other people about that. And it's been, I think, a very important tool on a personal level, on a person-to-person level, where you can really relate. Very often, nuclear weapons are an abstract thing. They're something that very few of us have ever seen. So to bring it down to that level of the company that receives your direct deposit every month from your paycheck, that makes it a little more real, and I think can start to have those kind of conversations that you're talking about. So I think that's really important. on a slightly bigger level, the city of Cambridge, Massachusetts, just a few months ago, the city council unanimously passed a resolution to divest their city's pension fund from nuclear weapon producing companies. So that's something that some local activists got together. They exerted the right amount of pressure on city council. They got this resolution passed, and now that's billions of dollars that are not going to be funding nuclear weapon producing companies. And again, so that creates local media attention. That gives the opportunity for us to have the conversation in the community about this profit over people situation that is currently happening and the things that we have really within our grasp and reasonably within our immediate grasp to change. So that's something that I'm really excited about and would really recommend highly to all of your listeners.
That's a great example to bring up. Don't bank on the bomb. And people can find that online and look it up and see if your bank is one of those companies, or your city, or your pension fund, or your company that you might work for. I think that you bring up a point that is very much on my mind as I live here in the shadow of Los Alamos, is that Los Alamos and the other nuclear weapons laboratories in New Mexico comprise 12% of our economy. It's huge. It's enormous. I mean, the second runner-up in our economy is the entire arts division of New Mexico, which includes tribal and Hispanic and the Anglo art scenes, all the museums, all the cultural tourism. So you get a sense of what a demand on our economy this is. It's also, I think some of the work of other people have demonstrated that every dollar we invest in the military is really not doing the same hard work that a dollar invested into some other part of the economy does in terms of creating more jobs, in terms of multiplier effects, in terms of circulation through our neighborhoods and community and local economies. And so it's a really big reflection for us as a nation. We mentioned at the start of the show that the U.S. is going to spend $1 trillion over the next 30 years to modernize our nuclear weapons arsenal. All of our listeners just reflect, what if we spent that $1 trillion over the next 30 years modernizing our approach to student higher education so that we don't have another entire generation of students coming out of college so shackled with debt that they're not getting married, they're not having children, and they're not buying houses. This is having a tremendous impact on our culture. At the end of the 30 years, do we want more nuclear weapons, or do we want a healthier, more vibrant society that has really supported and nourished people? My question for you is, what else can people do? One of the things that's on my mind is that we're approaching the end of the Hibakusha's lifetimes. The Hibakusha are the people who survived the nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so the lived experience of having been bombed is fading from the planet. And the messages they said to us as we commemorated the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was, please start telling the stories because we are going to be gone and we won't be able to tell these stories anymore. What can we do to help people become aware of the very, you know, tough and gruesome stories, the realities of nuclear weapons?
For me, hearing the personal testimonies of Hibakusha, of survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, is just beyond powerful. It's the most powerful experience probably that I've had in my life, certainly as it pertains to social activism. And I would recommend, if anyone hears of such an event happening in your community or even a neighboring community, drop everything and go. It's unlike any experience that I could even describe. So you're right, we've got to listen to these people's living voices while they remain. The bombings were 71 years ago, so even those who were the youngest during the bombings are getting up there in years, and there really is no perspective like that. So yeah, I'd certainly recommend that. There's also a film that I find very powerful, to bring it back to the Marshall Islands for a moment, by a New Mexico filmmaker named Adam Horowitz. The film is called Nuclear Savage, and it describes in great detail the effects of nuclear weapon testing by the U.S. in the Marshall Islands. That is at nucleersavage.com. You can stream it on Vimeo rent it on Vimeo. That is also one of the most powerful tools that I've come across to get people aware and concerned and active on this issue. So I would say there's nothing like real life if you can personally meet a survivor, whether of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, or nuclear testing. I mean, we have many survivors of nuclear testing here in this country who have lived through the effects of the many tests that we conducted in Nevada. But so beyond personal exposure to these people and their stories, I think film is very important, and there are a number of films out there that I think get the job done and can really bring home the really just unbelievable effects that nuclear weapons have on people.
I think that that's one of the things that's really most encouraging and most inspiring about our capacity today, is our ability to be able to share those types of stories with one another easily. We have the social media capacity to be able to reach the entire planet within a short period of time, really, and the ability to be able to listen to one another in ways that we haven't had in the past, which makes this a very opportune time to be alive. And so the way that we share those stories and the stories that we tell frame our future. And I think we also need to be very conscious about the stories that we have been telling, the stories that promote this idea that might is right, the stories that glorify acts of conquest and domination, that the hero's journey has been hijacked to really be the glorification of warmongering throughout history. And all of those stories that we've told kind of reinforce this idea that this type of power is authentic, when in fact it's not. It's an illusion. The most authentic power that we have is the power that we have as human beings in connection, in community, cooperation and collaboration with one another. And as we start to move forward, there's a way for us to tell a new story. So if you were going to sit down and talk about, you know, sharing pictures of your beautiful child on Facebook, you have one of the most beautiful children that there is out there on Facebook or in any universe. And if you were going to sit down with a group of her peers and tell them a new story for going into the future, what would that new story be? What would you like the future generations and the younger generations that are alive today to carry with them into the future that might shape for us a new way of being with one another?
One of the greatest things that I've experienced as being a father, my daughter just turned 7 a few days ago, is the understanding that she and many of her peers have, not only about just kind of our global interconnected nature, but also just a simple right and wrong. I'm able to talk to my daughter about the work that I do, not in the gory details of exactly what would happen if a nuclear weapon was used, but the ideas behind them and the fact that they hurt a lot of people. And the young generation, in my experience, realizes that that's wrong, and that's not the way that we should be relating to others. And so, to me, I think that one thing that I feel is very important to reinforce with children is hope and belief that the way the world is now and the injustices that are happening now and that they might be aware of, that stuff can change. And they are going to be the ones that make those changes. So I think not getting across some of the cynicism that I think is easy for us as adults to have and to hold on to, I think that keeping it in the hopeful category and the belief that not only is another world possible, but that they can make it happen. I think it's a very empowering message and something that resonates with them. That's something I talk to my daughter a lot about, not every night, but every once in a while when it comes up. And I think she believes it. And I'm really happy about that. And as she gets older, I think I'll be able to have more in-depth conversations about that, both with her and with her peers in her classroom. So I would hope that those of your listeners who are teachers will also welcome these sorts of conversations in your classrooms. I think that's a great place to have it and something that is really important for the long-term development of our children as individuals and also as a community.
Thanks for reminding us about that, Rick. It's so important. And one of the things you were reminding me as you spoke is that I was just barely being born when the Clamshell Alliance and all the other various alliances put a stop to a plan for 6,000 nuclear energy facilities throughout the U.S. The people, in a time when consciousness was just rising about the real dangers of nuclear power and alongside of the nuclear weapons. We don't have time to go into that today, so we'll have to get it on another show of Love and Revolution Radio. But I want to remind listeners that we are speaking with Rick Wayman, who is the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation's Director of Programs. He's been working closely with an international legal team and representatives from the Marshall Islands, coordinating a collaborative effort of over 100 NGOs in support of the Marshall Islands lawsuit in the International Court of Justice at The Hague to sue the 9 nuclear nations to get them to open negotiations on nuclear disarmament and nonproliferation. Rick, where can people learn more about the work that you're doing with the Marshall Islands or on the broader issues associated with nuclear weapons?
Well, there's a campaign website in support of the lawsuits, and that is at nuclearzero.org. That has all of the documents that have been filed, both in the international court and here in U.S. court, as well as background information, a lot of the media coverage that has happened over the past couple years. And then the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation also has a website with a lot of articles, a lot of information, and a lot of sources of hope. So I hope that your listeners will check that out as well, and that is at wagingpeace.org.
Great, and thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your knowledge, wisdom, and insight, and your sense of hope, as well as perseverance, here on Love and Revolution Radio. Thanks this week to our guest, Rick Wayman, and thanks to Sherry Mitchell for providing her usual insight into matters of the heart and also matters of the legal courts. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
I'd also like to thank my incredible co-host, Rivera Sun, for her insightful and informed commentary that she brings to the show each week. If you enjoyed this show and the things that I had to offer, you might also enjoy the things that I post on my Facebook page, Sacred Instructions, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it. All you have to do is give them a call and ask them. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera Sun's website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. After Rick mentioned Don't Bank on the Bomb today on the show, I snuck aside and looked it up. It turns out that Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, State Farm, Wells Fargo, and 221 other U.S. companies are all on the list. So, listeners, maybe you'd best go check that out and see if you need to move your money to be sure you're not banking on the bomb by the time we talk to you next week.